have to do is turn off my cell phone.
Thank you. A call to order this meeting of the Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. I'd like to remind folks to turn their cell phones off, not vibrate or silent, or else it interferes with our recording equipment. Since I just remembered mine, I get to remind everybody, with one possible exception, who tries not to make eye contact with me when I say this, Mr. Murphy. Okay, he has good reason to have his on. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2460. Representative Maurer, welcome. Would you like Scott to come up with you, or?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, that's it.
And Scott Ekblad.
Yeah, this is it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the measure broadens the Oregon Volunteer EMT Tax Credit eligibility criteria to emergency medical technicians working in an area with a population of fewer than 75,000 or at least 25 miles from any city with a population of 30,000. Takes effect on 91st day following adjournment, sine die.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ron Maurer, serving House District 3, which is most of Josephine County. And House Bill 2460 was kind of started in several ways. Had a conversation several years ago with a constituent in Representative Freeman's district about EMT issues and the inability and how the law was written. We had a long conversation. Of course, those conversations kind of sit in the background, in the back of your mind. It was about a year and a half later that I was contacted by Scott Ekblad, who is more of the expert in this area, about essentially the same issue. And I mean, what you'll discover is that the use of these tax credits in rural communities are extremely valuable for incentivizing providers, and in this case, EMTs, to continue providing services in parts of our state that are not as well served as the urban areas. And so, you know, any time we talk about money, in fact, I don't know what the fiscal, it hasn't been issued yet, and I would assume there would be a fiscal associated with it, is a very difficult conversation, I understand. But the fact remains that we need to help protect rural Oregon, and if it doesn't work this session because of the money issues, then it still needs to be held on the front burner in future dates. So I will conclude my remarks and answer any questions, although I will pass the expertise gavel over to my colleagues.
Thank you. And just for the record, I can't imagine anyone on the Emergency Services Committee not understanding that EMT stands for Emergency Medical Technician, but we'll clarify that.
Yes, Madam Chair, I made a grand assumption.
In my vocabulary, EMT is a word, but then I have a particular affinity for that group of people. So. Scott, welcome.
Thank you very much. Chair Cowan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad, and I am the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. I'm here to support the concept behind this bill and to respectfully suggest some amendments to it that would make the program stronger and more effective in recruiting and retaining volunteer EMTs in rural communities. As you are likely aware, but I want to make sure is broadly understood, when an urban Oregonian leaves Portland or Salem, I wonder if they understand that the outcome of their potential car crash is often dependent entirely on the goodwill of a total stranger, and that in many rural communities, all the EMS services offered are done by volunteers, and in many communities, it's a combination of paid and volunteer. And that particular total stranger decided to devote 150 to 200 hours of their lives to become trained, that they paid $1,000 to $1,500 to pay for that training, that they devote their hard-earned training to volunteering for their community, that they paid a further about $400 a year for continuing education, and that their employer is just as altruistic as the volunteer, because the employer has to let the EMT go when the call comes in, whether it's paid time off or not. So the intent of this tax credit program for rural volunteer EMTs is to reimburse these dedicated individuals for all the out-of-pocket expenses. And there's no suggestion here that it even comes close to the total amount that these volunteers spend. The bill as it's currently written would extend eligibility for the program to include not only those who get the benefit now, but also to include folks in counties of a population of 75,000 or fewer. What that does is adds all of Polk County to the program and the lower half of Columbia County. And so that is certainly one option. I would like to suggest a few other scenarios, and attached to my testimony are three different maps that give you a visual representation of the communities that would be included under certain scenarios. If you look at the first attached map, the communities in red are those that would be added to the program if the eligibility criteria was changed from what it is now, and that is communities at least 25 miles from a community of 30,000 or larger. If it was changed to a community 15 miles from a community of 30,000 and larger, the communities in red would be those that would be added to the program. The second attached map is if you looked at the criteria, if you looked at changing the criteria to include people that are 15 miles from a community of 40,000. And what we're really talking about here is Grants Pass. Grants Pass is just over 30,000, has traditionally been considered rural in all the other incentive programs that the Office of Rural Health administers. We now consider rural to be 40,000 and under. So if you looked at 15 miles from 40,000, the communities in red on this second map are those that would be added to this particular program. And then the third map would be the towns that would become eligible if you looked at 25 miles from a community of 40,000. So my whole point here is we can consider a number of different scenarios to increase eligibility for the folks in this program, or I should say expand eligibility criteria for participation in this program. Our office is happy to work with the committee to come up with any scenario that you think is reasonable and justified. And then let me just share with you some of the suggested amendments to this program that the folks who currently get the benefit have asked our office to bring to you. One is that the benefit be increased from $250 a year to $500 a year. A second is to add first responders to this program. The program currently is only extended to emergency medical technicians, and that's EMT basics, EMT intermediates, and paramedics. But first responders are often the backbone of the emergency response in a rural community, particularly a very small rural community. So adding first responders is one possible amendment. And then really most important, I think, of all, is that there's currently a sunset on this program, and it's due to sunset January 1st of 2011. And so I would respectfully suggest that the sunset be lifted on this program.
Thank you.
You're very welcome, and I'd like to...
Madam Chair, may I chime in on this? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Representative Maurer again. And the amendments that are suggested, I think one thing that needs to be, and we understand it in hilly rural areas, the 25-mile circumference is 25 miles as the crow flies. And as you know, in rural parts of the state where you have mountains, 25 miles is not 25 miles when you drive it. And so in the situation in our district, and I did not have this bill drafted specifically because of Grants Pass, but Representative Freeman's district extends into Josephine County. There's a small town called Glendale. Glendale is not eligible for this the tax credit now, but if you've ever been there, you would say, yes, this is rural Oregon. And so that's really what stirred it. And so we just need to be cognizant that if there are amendments drafted, that we have to be careful what we're saying. And I have great faith in Scott and his work. The other thing is, Madam Chair, is actually to request the fiscal so that we, because honestly, we don't know what this is going to cost. And it would be very helpful in any conversation to have at least a number to be able to talk about.
Thank you. And I do recognize that we have a third person here. I think, let me see if there's any technical questions of the first two presenters before we move on. Well, then I do. I'm a little confused, Scott, about the presentation of the maps that talk about any given number of miles from a population center of, et cetera. And the way I read the bill is that the major change in it is to change it to qualifying by being in a county with a population of fewer than 75,000. To either of you, I guess that's where my confusion is.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I understood the bill to add that as a secondary criteria. So that would be in addition to the current eligibility, which is 25 miles from a community of 30,000.
Okay.
And just as an aside, approximately 450 people currently qualify for the program with the existing criteria.
Okay. And I guess in follow-up to that, I'm assuming the scenarios then about distances from a certain number of miles from maybe major population bases, those are areas that probably would not qualify under the county population because of some population centers. Is that correct?
Correct. The areas that would be added under the bill as it's currently written are all of Polk County and the lower half of Columbia County. No other areas of the state would become newly eligible for the program. And as you can see,
you can see I'm calculating numbers in my brain.
Yeah. As you can see from the map, we don't even portray most of eastern Oregon because all of those counties currently qualify.
Well,
there are no communities larger than 30,000 other than Bend.
But I, not to be argumentative, but a county with a population of fewer than 75 would be broader than Polk and Columbia. Lincoln, for example.
I should say that newly eligible. So in other words,
the areas
all of Lincoln County,
volunteers in Lincoln County are currently eligible. Okay,
correct.
Gotcha. Okay. I want to make sure we understand what it is we're talking about here. Okay, thank you.
Chair.
Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair. When did we pass this initial legislation?
Chair Cowan, Representative Comp, I believe it was 2005.
Right. That's what I was thinking back. And do you happen to remember the fiscal on it at that time?
I do not, but if someone was quicker with mathematics in their head than I am, if you took about 450 times $250,
That would be the current fiscal.
That'd be my best guess.
Thank you. How much?
90,000.
It's about
90,000
in Miami.
90,000. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Boone? Thank you, Madam Chair. Last year when we tried this again to include first responders, we came up with approximately 8,000 volunteer firefighters / volunteer firefighters or EMS first responders and EMTs. Some people serve dual purpose, put it that way. So what we did was we queried districts, and these were just volunteers, not paid. We queried districts for their number of firefighters, number of EMS workers, and then if they were both the same, then we put it. Is that right? I see Jenna nodding. So around 8,000, is that still about right? Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, since
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Since we've got into a little discussion here, I think this is a very good thing, and that It should be continued. The sunset will expire in 2011, which means that we actually need to do something this session if we intend to extend it. But this bill, as I read it now, has no sunset. And I find it extremely difficult, no matter what, how wonderful the bill is, the credit is, to vote for any credit without a sunset.
Thank you. Okay. We also have Rose Howe, is that correct,
yes,
with
correct.
Us? And let's make sure that we hear from you before we move any further here.
Thank you very much. Well, Chair Cowan, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I wrote a little note to you here, and I'm just going to let you read it. And I've decided that what I need to do is just talk to you a little bit, very briefly, about myself. Something I'm not comfortable doing, and I do not normally do. I would like to tell you a little bit about what it's like to be a rural, and I actually call myself a frontier EMT. I'm from Grant County, Oregon, in a little village called Monument. We have approximately 126 folks in our surrounding area, including local ranches. And in Grant County, we are extremely fortunate in the Monument-Kimberley area to have rather a large percentage of EMTs and first responders. So if anything happens to you in Grant County in our area, you'll be well taken care of.
Excuse me, can I interrupt you for just one moment? The
certainly.
Interference that we're hearing is a cell phone. So if we could everybody check one more time to make sure theirs are off, I would appreciate it. And I apologize for
no
the interruption.
Problem at all.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Shall I continue?
Please do.
Okay. I've been an EMT for approximately 10 years. 9 of those have been as an intermediate, the level that's below a paramedic. And one of the large problems we see in rural Oregon, whether it be on this side of the mountains or the other side of the mountains, is the recruitment and retention of volunteer EMTs. I was fortunate to be able to teach an EMT class a couple of years ago. I'm teaching one at the moment. The class that I taught a couple of years ago, I had 11 students in there, and if we averaged the age of the students, it was 54. We have a very hard time recruiting some of the younger members of the community. And it's not necessarily that they do not want to do this out of the goodness of their heart, because they do. One of the big problems is the amount of time it takes to become an EMT and remain an EMT, and the cost of travel. I myself, as an intermediate, am obliged to travel to John Day once a month to maintain my intermediate recertification hours. For me, that's, if the roads are good, an hour's drive. It's a 120-mile round trip, and I do not get any compensation. I pay for all my own petrol and, of course, the time it takes. With our hospital being approximately 60 miles away from Monument, when our pagers go off, we are very fortunate if we are back home within 5 hours. Our average ambulance run is 4 to 5 hours. And I'm not complaining about it. It's why I've been doing it for this long. But one of the things that I have done as an EMT to try and help EMTs in our area is I've become a CPR instructor. I have become an instructor for the state of Oregon, which allows me to teach recertification classes. And I've done this in an attempt to keep EMTs in our region and other areas of Eastern Oregon by having the ability to teach them to the standards they need to be taught in our local communities. They no longer have to drive the 120-mile round trip to John Day to get their education. And I'm not the only one who does this. There's many volunteers who do this. The tax credit that we get, although for a lot of people it might seem like a drop in the bucket, when you get very little recognition, and excuse me if I burst into tears, I get rather passionate about this, other than the occasional potted plant or a nice card from somebody that you have helped, we in Grant County get absolutely no recognition from our local hospital. And I'd say that whether all the board of directors was sitting in front of me. We do not even get a t-shirt from them. We have to supply our own t-shirts and sweatshirts from fundraisers that we do ourselves. And once again, I'm not complaining about that, but for those folks in communities like ours who have to do everything ourselves in order to give to our community, oh, thank you.
Just in case.
Just in case. To give to our community and our friends and family members and neighbors, this little tax credit, believe it or not, is kind of like a little pat on the back from the state of Oregon when our own hospital and sometimes some of our other community members kind of forget sometimes to say thank you. This is one little incentive that says, you know, become an EMT, because guess what? At least the state of Oregon will give you $250 tax credit. And, you know, in all honesty, you know, Scott is all for raising it, and that would be marvelous, but I, for one, am jolly happy just to get that $250. And I can certainly understand the reason why you would want to have this revisited and have a limit on it and come back and talk about it at another time. But, you know, I would like to just say to you, those volunteers throughout the state of Oregon are very proud. Oh, here we go. Very proud to be volunteers. And we appreciate any little thing that you can do to help us out, because believe me, it helps us out. And I should probably stop there because I really am going to cry.
Thank you very much. I'll pick it up for a moment and see if I can keep from joining you. The first time I drove an ambulance was while I was living in Long Creek, which, for those of you who don't know, is just down the road from Monument.
Wow, you were in Long Creek?
I was. I lived there for a year, and that was my first experience on an ambulance. After that, I spent a number of years in Elgin, where I also was an EMT, too, and taught many of the classes for many of the same reasons that you've just expressed. So I appreciate very much your lengthy trip here today to join us, and you have the utmost empathy from at least one member of this committee. So thank you very much for sharing today. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. To illustrate rural Oregon, as this lady's talking about, back in the early 70s, I started hunting into a red-hot town called Kimberly. When I first started hunting there were seven people there. And when I finished 22 years later, when I quit hunting there, because I'm not able to run up and down the mountain like I used to, there was five because they closed down the feed store. Now that is rural Oregon. And it's usually 15, 20 minutes from anything. So I sympathize and empathize with you and understand what you're talking about, because that is truly rural Oregon.
And the reason that you know where Monument and Long Creek are, because Kimberly's in the same neck of the woods.
<That's right. laughs>
Representative Boone, I believe.
Thank you. And you have another friend here, a sort of relapsed first responder, because I've hurt my back and neck in the last 2 years. So I am now the queen of fire setting of the flares.
Oh.
And the hand.
Oh, yeah. Please, could you clarify?
I scared him. I'm just checking to see if he's awake. Firing up the flares and holding hands.
Okay.
And mostly on really bad high-speed car crashes. I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm sorry that your hospital doesn't recognize you. I enjoy a lot of recognition. I'll probably blushingly too much recognition for what we do. But until people have that experience of being attended to on the road. And I had at the time the trauma coordinator at Emmanuel in Portland accompany us on a couple of calls, and she was just stunned because what she gets prepackaged, ready to go, is a whole different scene than what we find. And we do the very best we can, and you're absolutely right. It's out of the goodness of people's hearts, and they don't think about the money that much at all, other than now it is getting to be more difficult to find people young enough because sometimes their employers don't let them go or they can't afford to miss work and have the hours cut in that sense. So there are a lot of reasons to support this, and I think that if you do the test of the budget ways and means test of, you know, if the little money up here, is it going to save you a lot back there? Scott, you probably know from being up at OHSU, the emergency department up there who we ship to when it's that bad, what we do in the field can make a real determination on whether that person not only lives or dies or the quality of their life when they do live. So I stand behind you 100%. Someday I may get back to it, and my age is actually over that average. So I appreciate you coming all the way out here to talk to us today, and I appreciate Representative Maurer for bringing this forward, and appreciate all you do, Scott, and for your support, too. And then a few people peppered in the back who are here to also know what we're talking about and support. And even though he's paid, I know he does, too.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair. Thank you.
She kind of makes you proud to be an Oregonian, doesn't she?
There you go. Yeah. Representative Matthew.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's okay.
Sorry about that. Yeah,
the Essel Trail. And that's true. I am a paid career firefighter with Gresham, and I'm also a union president, but I also understand the tremendous need throughout the state for our emergency responder and our volunteers. My question is, and I want to say, as I told you before, Representative Maurer, I'm very supportive of this bill. But I want to say, when you talk about the different tiers of what you're trying to do with first responder and then the EMT, basic, intermediate, and paramedic, have you considered a level of, we're not working this bill, I understand, today, but have you considered maybe putting in different levels of tax credit that would be for each of those certifications, try to stair step it so that maybe if somebody's a paramedic, they get to that 500 level, but if they're EMT basic or the bottom line, I guess, is I think we would all desperately want to have a bill that we could support that would be successful to get out of not only this committee, but through the floor and through the Senate. Our communities are all suffering right now with a tremendous amount of budget crises. We're suffering it throughout the state. We're going to demand heavily on volunteers to step up in their communities. Have you considered that at all as a potential? Is that something that you would entertain?
Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, that isn't something that we considered, but I can tell you that the Office of Rural Health is happy to help craft any amendments or improvements to this program that the committee deems appropriate.
Thank you very much for your service. Yes, follow up. Thank you. But thank you very much for your service. And I certainly understand we are not involved in transport, but for you to not only volunteer in your community, but be a transport provider, good for you. And thank you for your service.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Make sure no one else wants to give their life history here.
And Madam Chair, just as a follow up, I think Representative Riley's point is very well taken. These tax credits and sunsets are really, I think, it is an issue.
Yeah.
And I don't want to see this thing just, just kind of wither away. If a sunset will save the bill, then you'll do what you need to do. Because it is important.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to suggest, and in the interest of time, we're going to need to get to our next bill, but it appears that there is some work that needs to be done on this, potentially some amendments. First of all, the sunset issue certainly needs to be addressed because the existing credit will sunset if we don't do something with it, and I think that's important to make sure that we can attend to that. Secondly, I've heard several suggestions around expansion of the initial proposal, be that a stair-step arrangement, the size or the number of individuals that might be covered, the amount. So if maybe we could think through that and go ahead and get whatever appropriate amendments submitted that we might be able to work that would be appreciated by this committee. And thirdly, I think some of that determination needs to be made before then we can subsequently get a fiscal impact determination. Obviously, we need to figure out how many people we're talking about before we can do that. And if we get that information as to what amendments are proposed, then you can work with the committee administrator to let him know, and I'm sure that we can begin to get a fiscal determination on it and then bring it back to take a look at it again in this committee. Obviously, there's a sentiment on this committee that supports the concept and very much supports what our volunteers do for us. The question is, what or can we get through this session and to at least try to make sure that we hang on to what we do have? Representative Riley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just as a recommendation, a six-year sunset would be about right.
Is that any other input from the committee as to what you'd like to see worked in amendments?
Perfect. So.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
And I'll work
We'll be happy to work with you on it then. Yeah. And again, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much for listening.
For what you do. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2460 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2098. Are you going to go
present? Yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. I might need those Kleenexes.
Yeah, that's what I was going to do. You're right. I always forget it.
You've got
some. Mr. Molina.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2098 appropriates monies from General Fund to State Department of Geology and Mineral Industries for Oregon Territorial Sea Mapping Project at Oregon State University. Declares emergency effective July 1, 2009.
Thank you. And Representative Boone, would you like to tell us what we're talking about here?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. This is a big day for me. This bill, this is our third time trying to get this through, and hopefully the third time will work the charm. So I have come loaded for bear today. You all have received letters from a variety of support behind me and not behind me and in Washington, D.C. and all around the world. This is a big deal. Seafloor mapping is vitally important to our state for a variety of reasons. And since I come from the coast, and there are several coasties around here at this building, we are very vulnerable right now to tsunami, earthquakes, etc. And this is one of the integral parts of our arsenal, if you will, our tool bag, so that we can know what's going to happen, what's going to happen when it happens, how it's going to affect us. I'm not going to go into all the details there because some of my arsenal in the back of me will give you those details. But I wanted to give you some of the uses of bathymetry mapping, and the tagline is map once, use many times. And this is, I can't steal the quote, it's from Roger from NOAA. You can use it to locate hazards, tsunami modeling, marine research, navigational chart updates, habitat, nearshore and nearshore habitat, and fisheries research, and renewable energy sources in the ocean, such as wave, tidal, and wind. And one of the most important pieces of this project will be that in order to get this, you have to go out in a little boat and have some equipment on the boat. And in order to get out there, you have to have somebody to drive the boat. And a lot of those boats and drivers or captains will be our fishermen. And this is really important to the coastal communities as some of the fishing has been curtailed for a variety of reasons. And in that statement, that the fact that you're paying fishermen to go out and provide this or collect this data with the scientists, the money stays in Oregon and in the coastal communities. This has a lot of support. California and Washington are mapping. I have to say I'm very envious of California. They passed a $90 million bond issue for clean water, and they used about 20% of it for their mapping project. We've been offered help with our mapping efforts Last summer, we had an opportunity to have 2 weeks' worth of work done, donated ship time, et cetera, and we were not able to take advantage of it, even the $30,000 or so cost, because we didn't have the money for it. So what started as House Bill 2924 in the 2007 session came out of a visit from Dr. Don Wright and Dr. Chris Goldfinger, and Dr. Goldfinger's here today, and a small little presentation they gave to the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. And I've watched, that was in 2006, and I watched that become where we are today through a variety of efforts and their tenacious work, working grant to grant at the OSU Mapping Lab, just working a piece at a time to get this done. And I think we were about 5% then, maybe a little bit more, but not much more, and we need a lot more. And the rate it would take them at that rate would be about 50 years to finish the mapping, and we don't have that kind of time to wait. So I know David, you have a plan, so I will skedaddle out of here and let the experts now tell you why we should do this. Thank you.
Thank you for your tenacity in making sure this keeps coming back.
Pit bull here.
Heard that. So, okay. Probably it makes the most sense to open with Drs. McConnell and Goldfinger. Thank you for coming and welcome.
Thanks for having us.
We're not allowed to see the secret code here.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting for them to set up, I wanted to point out that the entire Coastal Caucus, or 9 members in this building, are very supportive of this, and you should have received a letter from them also.
Didn't actually notice the Coastal Caucus letter in here.
Is it there?
No.
I have it.
So we probably, if you could make sure that David is able to get this to everybody, get that letter to everybody. I didn't see it in this packet.
Oh,
you've got it there?
I have it in my mail file.
Well, who knows why I don't have it in mine. Probably because I signed it.
Upper right. Upper right.
Thank you. If everybody else does, don't worry about it. Are we ready?
We are ready. Good afternoon, everyone. Chair Cowan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and that allows me to call myself the state geologist, which is quite exciting. I'm here today to do is to give you a little introduction to really why would the state of Oregon be interested in collecting data and distributing data. What good does that do for the state, and what does it buy for us? And with me is Dr. Chris Goldfinger, who will introduce himself in a moment, and he's going to follow up my presentation with an explanation of how you go about collecting the bathymetry or the seafloor data, and really talking more about his program for collecting these data. So, and we are both available for any type of questions, both technical or general, on this. So, really, it is a great question to ask. Why would the state want to get into something as geeky as collecting a bunch of data and distributing it? But my argument to you on that is the applications for what you would use those data for are vital to almost all of the natural resource and land use agencies in the state to distribute those data to and information to cities and counties who look to the state for information and data, and to be used on and on. As Representative Boone said, map once, used many times. This is very true. This is not in just, but what you're going to hear a little bit from me today is really what would I use it in my program, and I think there'll be some other folks that can talk to you as well. Now, I stole this from Dr. Goldfinger, so you may see it again in his presentation, but this gives you an idea of some of the things that the applications that C4 mapping, which is really just generally what is the elevations, what's the geomorphology, the shape of the seafloor, but mapped at a very high detail. So things come into focus. That's very important. We're most interested in tsunami run-up models and anything that has to do with the tsunami mitigation for the state, because we're responsible for that, for taking care of that hazard for the state. Shoreline change analyses, analyzing storm impacts and coastal erosion. And I'm going to bring you a little bit of showing you why that, what is it about the marine environment that makes the shoreline environment so important and why are we so interested. And, of course, maps and visualizations, wave energy, there's a whole natural resource issues, and very much so emergency response and impact assessment. So you're not going to get away without a geology lesson today. So I'm going to make it quick, but you have to have it. The reason Oregon is as attractive as it is landscape-wise, and the reason that the natural resources we have really starts with the basic dynamic geology of where our state is located on the North American plate and along the subduction zone. And so it is dynamic. It is changing all the time. The coast range is still rising. We still have active volcanoes. We still have valleys in the background. We still have active earthquakes. Because we have this subduction zone off of our coast, that means we have a dynamic and vital coastline, and we also have a tsunami and earthquake hazard, particularly to the coastal communities. So this is great and wonderful and exciting geology, but it makes work for us all the time. It keeps our area very vital and very dynamic, and we need to always be on top of that. And part of being on top of that is keeping up with the technology that allows us to understand it as best we can. Now, for the generation of a tsunami, and this is just one thing, but this is a visual that helps to think about it. If you go back, I go back one. If we have an earthquake that occurs on this subduction zone, what ends up happening is you have a large change. One side of that earthquake, one side of that fault is going to go up or forward, and the other side is going to go down. And we're not talking a few inches. We're talking a few meters when that occurs. So what that does to the overlying volume of water is cause a big volume change in that water. And think of it as a puddle. If you have a puddle of water and you chuck a rock into it, you've now changed the volume of that water. And the first thing that happens is you get a wave that ripples out from it in response to it. And that water has to go somewhere, and it goes toward the shore. And as it goes closer to the shore, it shallows. As you know, the shoreline shallows. So that wave that maybe didn't look like much when it was in hundreds or thousands of meters of water becomes very significant as that volume of water changes toward the shoreline. And it has no choice but to keep going in until you've accommodated that volume. So that's what makes a tsunami, what they call a tsunami wave, so threatening to the coast. It has no choice but to continue until the volume is accommodated. So what we want to know is, what exactly are those depths? What you want to really know are the details. Do you want to just be able to model what the inundation is going to look like on your shoreline based on a little bit of information out here at 100 meters? That's as much information as you have. What does the seafloor look like at 100 meters? Or would you rather really know what it looks like? It's something as bringing that focus in at about 10 meters. And so your little squiggles here become very highly detailed. When that information is then plugged in to our inundation models, we get a very accurate idea of what's going to happen at this shoreline. That's what bathymetry or seafloor mapping gets for you. It brings the information into focus so that whenever we are sharing that mitigation information with our coastal communities, we're not just saying, oh, well, it could be 30 meters high or it could be 80 meters high. You folks make your decisions based on that. We can more confidently say, we think, not believe, but we think that you would be safe if you're beyond, say, the 70 meter. I'm just picking numbers here, so don't quote me on any of those. We also want to be able, if you're looking at this, if you look at this, you want to know what the accuracy of the or bring into focus what's happening on the land side as well. And that is, we're also working on a sister program right now looking at bringing into focus the topography of the land called using LIDAR technology. You knew I couldn't go a whole discussion without mentioning LIDAR. Here's another example. I'll just quickly bring this. This, again, is looking at an example of this detail. This is in the Siletz. Here's the Siletz Bay right here. This is looking where we do have a little bit of higher profile and more precise seafloor mapping. And what you're looking at are navigation charts here. So do you really want all your navigation charts to be based on this very, very inaccurate and non-precise data, or would you rather be able to have your folks out there navigating, really seeing what the seafloor looks like? This is an example from the USGS, and I just want to quickly put this in. It just, again, helps you to bring in the focus. This is our older topography. This was state-of-the-art even a couple of decades ago. U.S. Geological Survey has done a wonderful job with both bathymetry and topography. But it's just, this is looking at it in a shaded relief, but it just isn't the amount of focus we can bring in today with the new technology, and there's really no reason that we're not using the new technology. So just to summarize for me, for my agency and the work that we do, here's just an example of some of the things that we would employ this bathymetric or seafloor mapping data when it's collected. We will accelerate our tsunami hazard mitigation program. This was something recommended by the Joint Interim Committee on Emergency Preparedness in 2007, and it's really vital for us to have these data to be able to do that. We'll enhance monitoring to the effect of climate change on Oregon near shore. And I want to stress that regardless of what we're doing with global warming or carbon tax credits or anything, there are changes that are happening to the shoreline now. And we need to be able to understand that and to plan and plan for adaptation. That requires the territorial sea, near shore, and estuary bathymetry. And finally, we want to couple together that near shore landforms, the LIDAR, and the bathymetry to form a seamless data layer, particularly along the coastline. So,
thanks, Vicki. Chair Cowan and Vice Chair Matthews and members of the committee, I appreciate your allowing us to take some of your time to talk about seafloor mapping today. And I'm just going to skip as quickly as I can over the, we have a little bit of overlap in our presentations, and focus on how we do this and just what the state of the art is now compared to what it could be or needs to be. This is a map of the Cascadia margin going from Vancouver Island to California. And these large blocks out here are areas that have been mapped for various purposes over the years. But these very small squares along the coast, these are what's presently available in state waters in the state of Oregon. So we've mapped, as Representative Boone noted, about 5%. After last summer, we might be up to 6% now.
Yay.
So a big improvement. But also, as she mentioned, it could take as long as 50 years to get a reasonably good map of Oregon state waters, and we're only talking about state waters. Our goal here really is to map the entire continental shelf. The modern data really ends at this black line out here at about 600 meters. And most of this shelf you can see, which is the productive area of fisheries in the Pacific Northwest, is also unmapped. Today we're talking about just state waters as an initial starting point, and that's the purview of the state. And the 5% is all we've got at the moment. Offshore, we're in pretty good shape. NOAA mapped deep waters deeper than 600 meters back in the 80s, and we have a reasonably good idea of what's going on out there. This is Astoria Canyon. But inshore, it's a completely different story. Believe it or not, these fellows in this boat are collecting the data that we're currently using in Oregon. This was in somewhere around 1939. And this is how they did it: a bucket of rope with a lead weight attached, and they threw it over the side, and they had marks on the rope, and it was called a lead line. And so about 95% of the Oregon margin is Oregon state waters are mapped just this way, which wasn't a big advance over the Phoenicians, and this fellow is using a pole to measure the water depth there. These were their survey markers. They painted along rocks and things to use compasses to chart their position. Sometimes they told the tourists that these were native pictograms, which is kind of an interesting story on the NOAA website. And so here's the result. Here's what you get from lead line surveys, is these spotty surveys. Occasionally they would note that it was sandy or whatever the bottom was made out of. But you can see the enormous difference between modern data and what we're currently using along Oregon and Washington. So as a response to all of that, a couple of years ago we developed this scientific consensus statement about seafloor mapping and all of its many uses that Vicki has begun to talk about, and had just a collection of the 20 leading scientists that we had easily at hand. We could easily fill 10 pages of signatures, but we wanted to fit this on 2 pages. And here's the same slide again, but we have, in addition to tsunami, we have a number of other issues at hand. Habitat issues are also a leading issue with seafloor mapping. And you can see with the lead line surveys, there simply isn't enough data there to even know, in a very basic sense, what's out there on the seafloor. But we also have wave energy, port security. Marine reserves have been big in the last couple of years. So there are a lot of issues that are presently, in a sense, hanging fire, because there's very little we can do about them with the present data. So as sort of an emergency interim product, our lab developed a map last summer that was used in the Marine Reserve process, and we were very lucky to find a cache of data, about 11,000 data points, that allowed us to produce a very crude seafloor map that was used in the Marine Reserve process. And here's how it was built. Literally, the old maps, the lead line maps, literally looked like this. And we would construct a topographic surface from those, put the data, the lithologic, the sample type data points on there. And we used other proxies for where the rocks were, like where the kelp is, aerial photographs of kelp and things like that, to build up a map that would look like this on the right. This is the Cape Blanco area. So now we have, we have a decent idea of where the rocks are, and that was just good enough for its purpose. But our hope is to retire this map as soon as we possibly can and move on to modern data. So to really have modern data to really assist for not only tsunami but habitat uses really has to map at the resolution that's needed for its purpose. And habitat data requires the highest resolution of all, because you're trying to map things that the locals are using, and the locals are small fish. So just to say a few bits about how this is done, this is just sort of a generic view of modern seafloor mapping. The ship marches along. We call it mowing the grass. And it, instead of collecting a single point with a guy and a rope, it collects thousands of points per minute as it marches along, and maps the seafloor at a resolution that you can decide in advance depending on what your purpose is. And luckily for us, the shallower the water gets, the higher the resolution is. So if you're mapping in, say, 50 meters of water, which is what the territorial sea average is, you can easily get a map that's 1 meter or less in resolution without working that hard at it. So, and you can also do it with relatively small boats. This is a sonar system mounted on the side of a small boat and get just spectacular imagery. Here's a sunken boat here and the skid marks, some of the skid marks it made when it sank and some debris from the ship and then some trawling marks made by trawlers alongside. So you can get spectacular resolution in shallow water. Here's an example of the importance of this for safe navigation and commerce. This is the San Francisco entrance, as people had never seen it before until just a year or two ago. And you can see this is the ship channel going in through the Golden Gate here, and these large sand waves. Ships that during the wintertime sometimes bottom out on these sand waves, and so this wasn't an academic exercise just to see what it looks like. This is an important navigational feature. And this little bit down here, this is the San Andreas Fault cutting across the entrance of San Francisco. So these are big, important features that we have only the vaguest idea of without seafloor mapping. In Oregon, as Vicki discussed, the tsunami that's coming is not just a prognostication. It's really an inevitability. This is the 1946 tsunami in Hilo, Hawaii, and it won't be long before the Oregon coast looks very much like this, except without the palm trees. And so I also wanted to mention that this the inevitability of this is well established in the scientific community, and now the arguments are about what the probabilities are. And so the most recent published probabilities are about 10% to 14%. But a new paper coming out this spring will show that southern Oregon has a range more on the order of 50% to 70% in the next 50 years. So the previous repeat time for great earthquakes in Cascadia applied really mostly to the northern part of Cascadia, and that's about 500 years. In southern Oregon, though, the repeat time is more like 250 years, and it's been 309 since the last earthquake. So the probabilities are climbing as we understand the earthquake threat more and more. And so there's a very real possibility that this earthquake will come in some of our lifetimes. Coastal erosion, another big issue that's very difficult, very intractable without seafloor data. It's hard to predict what waves are going to do, what the wave energy climate is going to be in a particular part of the coast without the underlying seafloor data. Wave energy, the same thing. Wave energy requires bathymetry and subsurface imagery to site the anchored arrays and as well as assess the impacts to habitat from having these arrays out on the coast. And habitat and ecosystem assessment. This has been a big topic of discussion the last couple of years with marine reserves high on the agenda. And seafloor mapping there again is critical to this. It's not a whether you're going to protect a part of the seafloor or not, or whatever the politics may be. For us to understand the impact of those reserves into the future, we need to understand the ecosystem that they're based on. And so this just shows that as you increase the number, the different types of seafloor, you increase the diversity of the critters that live there. And similarly, abundance goes up with the types and variety of seafloor. So understanding what lives there, what the abundance is, and how this relates to fisheries and all the human uses of the coast is critical for seafloor mapping. And this is just an example of what you can do when you actually have a good piece of data. Here's Haseda Bank off Central Oregon. And with this level of data, and a few relatively simple transects with a submarine, you can delineate quite well what lives there, what the percentages are of different species, how they're associated with the substrates they live on, and then you have a baseline to go forward in time to see how they're responding to any changes that might happen in the natural environment or in the regulations. And this is just the demonstration of that. I may just skip over this. So is all seafloor mapping the same? Well, no, it's not. Even though the motto is map once, use many times, there are different tracks that this data takes. And I'll just skip over this text and go straight to here and show you that for nautical charting, the goal is fairly simple. You want to go from the picture on the top to the picture on the bottom, and you're focused on the highest obstruction that a ship could run into. It's fairly straightforward, and the processing is linked to that type of analysis. For habitat and that works well for tsunamis as well. For habitat purposes, though, it's a different story. After you finish processing it to a level that's good enough for nautical charting, then it takes off and goes through many more steps to develop maps that look more like this, where you can pull information out like the grain size of the material, its hardness, its roughness, and actually what it's made out of, which is really what's involved in habitat science. So in California, they've followed this track. They've split their data into two tracks. One goes to nautical charting and is processed one way, and the other track goes to the academic science side, and it's processed for habitat to include these additional features that you see here. So what's the solution? Well, the West Coast Governor's Agreement on Ocean Health has established seafloor mapping as one of the critical needs for the entire West Coast, not just for Oregon. And there's the seafloor mapping action team is probably the farthest ahead of the groups that have been working on the seven issues, and have brought in NOAA. NOAA's been an active partner in this, and even though they're a little bit siloed in terms of what they do, they're trying to break out of that and help the western states. And so the WCGA has actually made a big impact back east, and Oregon and Washington and California are now high on the list of sites that NOAA, if they're able, will try to help out and get some of this work done. So in Oregon, we have a plan, as Representative Boone mentioned, to map state waters as a starting point. Again, we hope to get the whole shelf eventually, but state waters are a great place to start. And so this plan has been developed over the last several years through workshops, discussions with stakeholders, agency leaders, community, legislators, et cetera. And so our goal is to acquire simply high-resolution mapping data to 1 meter or less in state waters, for less than 10 meters of water, up to 10 meters of water depth. Acquire the ground truth, which means images, samples, and so forth, to develop the habitat maps from those in a dense array for the same area. And then merge all of these together to generate the habitat maps. And the acquisition of the key element of this, the acquisition of the data, would be done on local vessels, so we'd be putting local boats and crews to work using state money and keeping that in the state within the OUS system, and training students as well. So the benefits of this, besides all of the tsunami and the habitat and all of these issues, is we're trying to keep this in-house and create local jobs for local folks, and training and capacity building for new technologies. We have at OSU the Marine Resource Management Program. Typically we have about 25 students, and some of our leaders, including the governor's advisor on natural resources, came from the OSU MRM program. And so we hope to build this out even further and teach students how to work within these new fields, seafloor mapping and habitat. We think the cost of this is reduced overall in comparison to using commercial contractors. And probably key to all of this is state support could leverage federal funds to help complete the data acquisition that the state isn't considering at this time. So in California, that's the way it happened. California laid down some money to get the program going. And now they're on NOAA's highest priority to complete that work. They're 65% done. 2 years ago, they were 15 or 20% done. So it's really happening. And Oregon is in a great spot now, with a relatively modest amount of leverage, could get much more done and be next on the list for NOAA. And I think that's all I have. Oh, What does it cost? So costs per square mile vary a lot depending on fuel prices and the exact specifications of the surveys and the ground truth and so forth. But using today's costs, we estimate that the $1.2 million that's being considered would allow mapping somewhere between 20 and 35% of state waters out to 3 miles. So this includes integration of all the existing data, et cetera. So this is enough roughly to cover most of the marine reserve sites and proposed wave energy sites, just for example, although I'm not putting those out as the highest priorities. It does not include any leveraged work from the federal agencies, but we already expect some help there. We just don't know how much. But it does include some help from the NOAA Northwest Fisheries Science Center, for example, has contributed an autonomous underwater vehicle for an entire field season, which could be this year, and as well as 10 days of ship time also from NOAA. So these are just things that the team has been able to cobble together sort of under the radar, but there could be more help as well. So I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Rep. Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Goldfinger and Dr. McConnell, for coming for the third time before us. Second time was in 08, and we didn't get much of a chance, but I wanted to point out that we also have a real-life student in the room of the program you're talking about, and Anna Pakenham, who's our Coastal Caucus Legislative Fellow, and is taking advantage of this program. And I look forward to having this go forward and doing everything you said it would, and hopefully Dr. McConnell will be successful in D.C. when you go, or maybe you've already gone. No, you go. Okay. To get some money for us from the federal government to pick up the federal part. Colleagues, I just want you to know how long and hard these people have worked for this. This has really been a long, hard, so what you do every day, I know. And Chris and Vicki were both before this committee's other permutations back to 2005 even. And Dr. Goldfinger did spend some time in Indonesia too, studying the aftermath of the tsunami there. So he's really a wealth of information, and if you really want to get depressed, have him start talking about those issues. But thank you for both of you for all you've done.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for being here. It's a great overview to get us started on this conversation. We also have some folks from agencies here with us today. Louise Soliday, Paul Claren, Kurt Melcher. Do you want to all come up together? Or does that work for you guys? Thanks. We'll let them trade off with you here. But if you're able to stay till the end of the committee in case there's questions, that'd be great. Thanks. Can draw straws or jump in however you wish.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Louise Soliday, the Director of the Oregon Department of State Lands. And the department manages about 2.3 million acres of land and water around the state of Oregon, including the Territorial Sea, to generate revenues for the Common School Fund. And the Common School Fund then makes distributions to all 197 K-12 public school districts across the state. The Territorial Sea, I think as most people know, extends 3 nautical miles out from the ocean shore, and the Department of State Lands is charged with managing that state-owned land under several different statutory provisions. We are very supportive of getting seafloor mapping done, as is our governing board, the State Land Board, which is comprised of the governor, the secretary of state, and the state treasurer. We believe this is important information for us to have as we make management decisions related to the Territorial Sea. We currently have 11 fiber optic cables that cross the Territorial Sea that are under permanent easements from the department. We have proposals for wave energy projects. We have proposals for marine reserves, and there are probably other proposals that are coming in going to come in the future that we're not even thinking about today. And so having this kind of data will help to inform a lot of the decisions that the department and the land board will need to make over the next several years. There is a Dash 1 amendment that we worked with Representative Boone on that would change this bill to have the money, instead of being general fund to the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, give the Department of State Lands limitation in the amount of $1,289,000. That's the amount that's in our recommended budget. The money for that comes from remaining funds from the new Carissa trespass case settlement. So the money is in the governor's recommended budget as a part of the department's budget. So we are very supportive of the Dash 1 amendments to give the department the limitation necessary. As was the case under the original bill, the money would go to Oregon State University to do the work. It was would not be something that DSL would do. We would enter into an interagency agreement for OSU to complete the work, as Dr. Goldfinger described to you earlier today. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you, and I appreciate your clarification of the source of this funding. That's what I was hoping to bring out soon. Are there any specific questions, and does everybody understand the new Carissa trespass case settlement funds? Or if not, I'm sure we'll be happy to expand on that.
I know a brief overview. I know no depth in this subject.
Thank you. I just want to make sure everyone's at the same understanding levels.
Madam Chair, when the new Carissa ran aground in 1999, they were trespassing on state lands in the territorial sea. The state filed trespass charges against the owners of the ship and demanded demanded that they remove the ship or pay the state $25 million so that we could remove it. The case went to trial in front of a Coos County jury. The jury ruled in favor of the state, awarded the state $25 million as we had requested, and the ship owners appealed that. And during the appeal process, we entered into settlement negotiations, and as a result of those settlement discussions, the state received $20 million of the $25 million, plus the interest that had accrued on the $25 million because they had placed it in an account with the state. That ended up being a total of $23.3 million. We entered into a contract for the removal of the new Carissa a little over a year ago. That work was completed this year. There are about $2.9 million remaining from those settlement funds that were not used in the removal and the various paying back the common school fund for legal fees that were incurred. And so those monies are appropriated through the governor's recommended budget, this being one portion of that amount of money.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Paul?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Claren. I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Ocean Coastal Program. And the department strongly supports the bill with the amendments to assign the money to DSL to go to OSU. You've already heard enough from the presentations about the potential uses. I would further add that the information that comes from these maps is very much needed to support the process we're going through right now to amend the Territorial Sea Plan to site ocean energy off the Oregon coast. As you know, we have wave energy development already on our shores, but if you look at the technologies that are being developed now, there may be other types of ocean energy conversion devices that could be deployed, and we could expect to see them in the next 10 or 20 years, including those that might sit on the bottom. But we don't know about that bottom. We have very little information about our nearshore area. And so it's instrumental. It's important. We need to know that in order to site that type of development. We're going through the Territorial Sea Plan amendment process right now. That's based on maps. And essentially what we're doing is developing maps as you would on the land without knowing the topography. So you're assigning uses to different areas, not knowing if it's flat as a desert or if it's a mountain. And we essentially need to have that mapping component in order to really develop the sort of comprehensive mapping to assign uses to different areas along the Oregon coast. We expect to see in the future not only this type of industrial development, but aquaculture. Open ocean aquaculture is certainly in the future for us. And there might be even wind development on the surface of the water, wind energy development. That's been proposed as well, and it's being actually developed on the East Coast as we speak. So a lot of different uses might come our way. We need to know what's on the bottom. We need to know the configuration, the ecological resources that are there. And this is a point in time where we need to get this data and start applying it. Thank you very much. Take any questions you may
have. Thank you. I appreciate that. Questions for Mr. Claren? Mr. Melcher.
Thank you, Chair Cowan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the Deputy Director for the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and provided some brief written comments here as well. I do note that it's not the morning, it is the afternoon, although my testimony says good morning, so yours does too. Well, okay, so fortunately it is the afternoon. Just wanted to, and I'll be brief here, and for the sake of time, just wanted to express the department's support for these efforts, particularly with the Dash 1 amendments, which align this with the governor's recommended budget. And just also mention that in our ocean environment, we have very diverse, complex assemblages of fish, shellfish, and invertebrate species, many of which are worth tens of millions of dollars to the Oregon's recreational and commercial fishing industries. We, as mentioned in the earlier comments, we know very little about the habitat other than from some experiential data. Certainly many fishermen know many of these specifics, and they have them logged away in their own minds or GPS chart plotters. But from a department standpoint, we know very little about the structure and habitat on Oregon's seafloor, and this will take us make great steps in learning those and benefiting our management efforts to improve these fisheries. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee here this afternoon.
Thank you. Any questions for any of these three folks?
Madam Chair, no questions. I just want to thank them all for coming forward and being supportive of this. It's been a long time coming. Thank you.
Absolutely, and I do appreciate your coming. I think it helps give the committee kind of a perspective of where all we're needing this information. Thank you.
Thanks.
And I will recognize that you have before you the Dash 1 amendments. I think that the initial draft of the bill was to kind of get it in there, if I'm correct, Representative Boone, and the Dash 1s are intended to clarify just exactly how that needs to process.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we did. This was a pre-session filed bill by the interim committee, and it was originally to be run through DOGAMI, and when this became part of the governor's budget plan, we boogied it on over to DSL. Thanks to Louise for accepting that.
Follow the money.
We what? We jumped on it.
Ken, would you like to join in here?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and I would not want to miss my third time testifying on this. I will not belabor what you've heard. I can't think of too many bills that can provide so much data and information to help so many different people in so many different ways. Clearly, you heard Dr. Goldfinger Dr. McConnell talk about the tsunami issues. I just wanted to add really one more thing, too, that really does help me, and it will help for sure Representative Cowan, Representative Boone from the coast, that hopefully we are planning and using our money wisely in our cities and counties on the coast as we plan for tsunamis. And I'd like to think we are, but once you see the seafloor maps, that may tell you that we have other places to worry about, or maybe some places we don't have to worry about so much. So I just thought I'd bring that, you know, because it also helps us plan at the city, county, and state level to use our resources more wisely if we knew what that seafloor looked like. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Thank you. That's another excellent point. Any questions for any of the folks? Anyone else that wanted to testify on this bill today? Okay. It looks to me like this one is pretty ready to go with the amendments, so we'll bring it back for a work session fairly soon, unless we hear any other challenges that need to be addressed before we move it. Okay. Thank you. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2098. And unless the committee has any other business, we'll close this meeting of the Veterans Emergency Services. Thank you all for coming. It was